Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're beginning the show today by talking about elder abuse awareness. And we have a couple of guests for you today. One, Amber Hahn. She's the assistant district attorney for Fond du Lac County. Amber, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
With us as well, Doreen Gash. She is a social worker who works with elder abuse victims through the Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging Resources based in Walworth County. She's also a project coordinator for an abuse in later life grant in Walworth County. Doreen, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me as well.
So as we talk with our experts today, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about elder abuse? How to identify it, maybe? How to report it? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Doreen, let's start with you. Tell us broadly maybe about elder abuse. What is it?
Well, it's clearly defined in our statutes. Wisconsin Statute 4690 identifies the areas of concern, which are physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, financial exploitation, and self-neglect. And elder abuse refers to an individual who is age 60 or older, and that is also defined by statute.
So where does elder abuse typically occur? Does it occur throughout the state?
It certainly does. In 2022, according to the Department of Health Services statistics, the state received over 10,700 reports of elder abuse in Wisconsin.
So there are a number of ways abuse can occur. What are the warning signs that someone is experiencing elder abuse?
Well, it depends which type of abuse you're looking at, but one must always remember that one form of abuse does not exist in a vacuum. There's usually polyvictimization is what we refer it to. So for instance, if someone is being financially exploited, they also may be being emotionally abused as well as physically abused or some other form of abuse.
And, you know, and as you say, it occurs throughout Wisconsin. We don't seem to hear that much about it, or I, you know, sometimes wish we maybe received more information about it.
That is true. We're doing what we can to educate everybody about elder abuse. Globally, World Elder Abuse Awareness Day occurs on June 15th. Throughout the world, and that is a day of recognition and education and informing people that this is clearly a problem that needs to be addressed.
So I'm trying to, there are all these different forms of it. Is elder abuse, when it comes to monetary or financial abuse, is that pretty common?
It is the crime of the century, financial exploitation. Billions of dollars are lost annually to individuals who are age 60 and above, and for those who are also 18 to 59. Those signs are pretty clear. They can be outright theft. They can be transferring of accounts. They can be sudden additions to someone's bank account or the depletion of bank accounts. It's very sad, and it's very devastating for the victims.
Yeah. Amber, let me turn to you for a minute. When there's a reported case of elder abuse, who is it that reports it typically?
Yeah, reporting can actually happen in a number of different ways. Traditional ways still work. So you can certainly go to your local law enforcement department to report suspected elder abuse. There's also other resources. Every county has an adult protective services in their county. They will have a toll-free and a local phone option where reports of elder abuse are received. Typically, that'll be between regular business hours, Monday through Friday, although they should also have an answering service usually if you want to report different hours. And those reports go to local social workers who by statute, respond within 24 hours to that report. And those statistics that Doreen mentioned, those are built off of those reports. So when she says over 10,700 reports, those are coming into our local adult protective services departments and then being recorded on a statewide basis. So those are probably the two best ways to report elder abuse. And I always encourage people to do both, especially if you believe an actual crime is being committed, that even if you do report to adult protective services, it's not a bad idea to also report to your local law enforcement.
Boy, it's... I'm thinking 10,700 or over 10,000 anyway, and then I'm wondering how many are not reported. Of course, we have no way of knowing, but Doreen, you're betting that it's more than 10,000.
Well, statistically, for every one report that is received, 23 to 24 reports never reach Adult Protective Services or are never reported. So think about this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Oh, man. What is, talk more about Adult Protective Services.
Well, Adult Protective Services is present in every county. And upon receipt of a referral, it is their job to start an investigation. They do background information to see if they've ever had contact with this individual. And best practice is to go to the alleged victim's residence and interview that person and decide from their conversations with them and maybe conversations of others, what is occurring and how. What sort of least restrictive intervention can be used to remedy the situation?
Desiree in Dubuque, Iowa has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Desiree.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
So I've been listening to you guys, and my question is basically, I have a grandmother. She's about 83 years old. And she has been dealing with this abuse for quite some time. And it's been something that I've tried to, you know, take my own actions with. But as far as reporting it to the authorities, what I'm running into is she lives in Arizona while I don't live there. So how do I go about reporting if the elderly person is in another state?
That's a good question, and that probably is fairly common, Amber.
Yes, it is. And what you would want to do is you would want to look for, you want to base it off of where the elder lives. So the grandmother, you would look to what city or village or county she's residing in. And then you can look up the law enforcement and adult protective services that are available in that area. And certainly would be good maybe to start with adult protective services because as Doreen said, usually they're going to do a visit or at least check their records to see if they've had contact with her in the past and really see if there's services that they can connect her with. You know, sometimes victims of abuse don't maybe necessarily want to talk about what's going on, or they might have reasons why they're hesitant to talk about it. And that contact can be really positive to maybe bring some services that that person might be willing to engage in that might help the situation.
Yeah, I would think, and Doreen is probably one of those, a lot of times maybe an elderly person who's, as kind of Amber was getting at a little bit here, who is being abused in one way or another, might be even afraid to or feel afraid to talk about it.
Absolutely. That is 100% correct. Most of the time, the abusers are family members or relatives. And most mothers and fathers and grandparents do not want to admit that their family member is causing them distress, abusing them, and they don't want them to be in trouble for it. They don't want a son or a grandson to go to jail after abusing them. So it's often a little dance to try to remedy the situation and do what's right for that elderly victim.
Yeah. Eric in Marquette County will give you a chance to join in. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry. So my wife's grandmother a few years ago came over to our house, and she said she was being abused by her daughter, which is my wife's mother. And we live in a small county, and my wife's mother's friends with the sheriff's department and everybody else. And so when they launched the investigation, she was called a week in advance and told that this was about to happen. So she was able to go tell her mother not to say anything. So nothing ever happened with this situation. She'd taken over her bank accounts, left her with no money or food. It was pretty bad, but nothing happened.
Oh, boy. Doreen, a comment.
Sadly, that should not occur. Most, if not all, Adult Protective Services visits should be an unannounced visit. There should be no warning given to anyone that this is occurring because of the fact that most of the time family members are involved. So I'm sorry that happened.
Yeah. Amber, anything else to add to that?
I guess I would just point out one thing, and I'm not sure, Eric, in your story, and again, I totally agree with Doreen, it should not have happened that way, and I'm so sorry that it did. One thing that occurred to me is that sometimes I encourage people to, if you have a situation like that where it is a small community and people are connected to one another, that Adult Protective Services might be a better place to start than law enforcement. I know you mentioned there was maybe a personal contact within law enforcement. And the reason being is that Adult Protective Services, there's certain confidentiality rules in play that are guarded pretty closely. And so sometimes if you're concerned about that sort of local interference or those local relationships maybe making a difference, that if the report goes to Adult Protection Services first, you should have a higher level of confidentiality with that first contact, if that helps at all.
Now, would that be, and I'm not telling Eric to do this, but would that be something that he might pursue his wife might pursue at this point?
Absolutely. I mean, you can't put the money back, right? He mentioned there was some money stolen, but and the criminal piece of it isn't helpful, but Adult Protective Services has other services and things that can be offered and that are, you know, not income-based. So if, you know, that contact can be helpful, at least to reach out to see if there's a service available that that individual might benefit from.
Eric, I'm sorry for your circumstances, but I really appreciate your call. Thank you so much, and I hope there's something that still might be done in this particular case. Sounds like there's some options. Doreen and Amber both commented on that. Appreciate your call very much. Doreen Gash is a social worker who works with elder abuse victims through the Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging Resources. Amber Hahn, assistant district attorney for Fond du Lac County. And if you have questions for them or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert is our producer today. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking a look at elder abuse, knowing the warning signs and how to report elder abuse with our two guests, Doreen Gash, a social worker who works with elder abuse victims, Amber Hahn, assistant district attorney for Fond du Lac County. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Samantha called, couldn't stay with us, called from Whitehall. What if you can't see signs of physical abuse on the victim and there's a case of dementia? How do you prove that something happened?
Well, I think there are other ways to prove that physical abuse is happening, even with dementia. Oftentimes people with dementia do have moments of clarity, and it's really important to perhaps interview that person or talk to that person at different times of the day. Perhaps they are really good in the morning, or maybe they experience what we refer to as sundowning in the afternoon. And if that's the case, you would want to avoid interviewing that person in the afternoon. Also, you'd have to look at where the bruising is occurring. A clear example of physical abuse would be bruising around the neck. That doesn't occur naturally when you take a fall or if you trip. I would want to get the doctor or the physician involved and maybe do a physical exam.
Yeah, that's a good part or good point, I should say. Well, what happens when there are criminal, Amber, maybe you can take this. What happens when there are criminal charges that stem from an elder abuse report?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So we have a number of statutes in Wisconsin that protect this population that address a number of different situations that might occur. And so ideally, if a case has proceeded to that point and is charged out, it's treated like any other criminal offense in Wisconsin, and it could resolve for some type of penalty, either supervised probation in the community, could involve monetary fines, or it could involve incarceration, either in jail or in prison, depending on the severity of the offense. If the person contests it, the case could end up in a trial setting, either in front of a judge or a jury, which does require sometimes, will require testimony of witnesses. But those are the two primary paths typically that a criminal charge would take.
We have a call from Cheryl in Clam Lake, so let's go there next. Cheryl, hi.
I just wanted the speakers to allude to financial abuse of the elders. I was a long-term care ombudsman in Ohio, worked for area agency there, and I saw a lot of financial abuse of elders, like in nursing homes or in assisted living. The family would use their credit cards, sometimes for just luxurious vacations, and also accessing the victim's bank account.
Yeah, Cheryl, thanks. Well, Doreen, we'll turn to you first for that. Doreen Gash?
Yes, that is definitely a crime, and that definitely needs to be reported to law enforcement and Adult Protective Services. Here in Wisconsin, Adult Protective Services has by statute a unique ability to get bank records without a victim's consent. Those bank records can tell a lot about what is happening and patterns of spending or questionable withdrawals or outright theft. So those incidents need to be reported. And I also want to add that Wisconsin has really a luxury of having a state Wisconsin elder abuse hotline. It's about 3 or 4 years old here in Wisconsin, and people can either make a report online at www.reportelderabusewi.org or by calling the toll-free number, which is 1-833-586-0107. These calls are taken Monday through Friday, 8 to 4:30, and that individual will then contact the county of responsibility where the alleged abuse is occurring.
You know what? I think we should just repeat that. The phone number is 1-833-586-0107. If I have that right.
And that is correct.
And the other, Wisconsin, go ahead and give that a
www.reportelderabusewi.org.
Wi.org. And we'll have that up on the Larry, on today's program notes today. So if folks didn't get that, and we'll probably repeat it another time before the show is over, because there are likely to be a few calls perhaps that will result from today's show. Cheryl, thank you so much. I'm wondering, maybe Amber, go to you to start anyway, the legal process for guardianship can come into play in abuse cases. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I like to talk about guardianship as well as just estate planning, because a lot of times when we talk about elder abuse, family members may say, you know, I have a family member or person in my life that I'm concerned about risk of abuse. Perhaps they have progressing dementia, or there's a condition that a family member says, what can I do to protect my family members? Or maybe, you know, you're in your 40s or 50s and you're doing some estate planning and you're saying, well, you know, how can I protect myself as I get older? And there's two. So what happens when we have an individual that's experiencing abuse, and if they're in a mental condition or physical condition where they're unable to make their own decisions, that's when a guardianship comes into play. It's a pretty restrictive thing. So guardianship is not really an ideal thing that you want to have happen. It's more of a protection in place, sort of as a last resort. And so what people can do, though, is when they're talking to their attorneys or they're setting forth their estate plan, you can plan for guardianship. In the event that someone would want to put you under guardianship, you can specify or put things in your estate plan to indicate who you would want to serve in that capacity, or what you would want to have happen. Attorneys can also advise you as to ways to avoid guardianship. There's certain ways that you can set up your estate such that you would have provisions in place if you were ever to be deemed legally incompetent. And so it's a way for individuals to have control over that. Unfortunately, dementia is very widespread. It's very kind of common. I don't know that research has gotten everything nailed down, but it's not a bad idea to plan for the worst and hope for the best.
Yeah. And I was thinking about, let's say you've got someone, and I can speak from experience on this because I'm power of attorney for my elderly sister and brother, both of who are in. And I, as a power of attorney, I write a lot of checks. And I'm very careful on making sure that everything is properly taken care of. But I can see where this, here you've got maybe a power of attorney who then can write checks and take money. This has got to be, for some people, it may be more enticement than they can handle. Let's put it that way, Doreen.
Yeah, and there are ways that, let's say you are a power of attorney for someone and you suspect that this power of attorney is not acting in that person's best interest. Anyone can petition the court to review that power of attorney. And what that does is set up a hearing, and this power of attorney has to go to court and, you know, explain exactly how they have spent this person's money.
Yeah. Amber, you were nodding in agreement there, I think.
Yeah. So I would just add that power of attorneys that are set up through like a will and estate plan, those, you know, if you do know of a situation like that where you have a person acting as a power of attorney and you have concerns, like Doreen said, maybe you're seeing something, or maybe you're employed at a bank, or you're interacting with that person in the community and you just suspect that there's maybe something not quite right going on, that is a great reason to make a report either to the state hotline or your county adult protective services. They can investigate that. And if there is something going on that's harming that elder, that can then proceed through the system so that remedies can be put in place. So it's a great way for community members to have an impact on a potential reduction of abuse in the community. I would also point out another kind of warning sign of financial abuse that impacts those of us that might work in the retail industry is if you see an older adult that's buying a lot of like Visa gift cards or Google Play cards, or, you know, if you work at, for example, we've had tips that come in from US, like US postal offices or like package sending places. If you're seeing an older adult come in and they're maybe sending a lot of packages, they're maybe even mailing cash, If you're seeing that happen, you know, please call and make a report to the state hotline. Your reporters are confidential. They are protected by statute. Even bank employees, you know, we are encouraged and you are protected under the law if you want to report these things. And then, you know, let the groups that are responsible for that investigate and find out if, you know, your suspicion is correct or not. But it never hurts to at least report it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what kind of aftercare is needed for an elderly person who goes through a situation where they are abused?
Well, I think it's important, and social workers are highly trained in this area, to, number one, remedy the abuse and then put in supports that will prevent further abuse. Perhaps this person needs some care around their home, or maybe they need a nutritious meal once a day or twice a day. So it's kind of like rallying around this person to see what they need and what it is that will keep them safe.
Mm-hmm. And Amber, anything to add there?
Just that every situation is very unique. You know, every individual has different needs. Everybody's family situation. Some of us have natural supports. Some of us don't. And so that's really where I think social workers are amazing, because they can come in and see where the help is needed and maybe where that help is already filled.
Yeah. I just have to wonder how this, an incident like what we've been talking about here, how that affects the people involved long term. I mean, it must be.
Well, it can be very devastating to a victim of abuse, especially, like I said, when it is a family member. And sadly, that is how most of the abuse occurs, is by family members. And it's very hard to admit it. And it's hard to, most people don't want to break or sever that tie with their family. And sadly, by limiting, I guess we have to limit what we can do and what they're agreeable to do. That's a fine balance.
Yeah, and I would think for other family members or family members, what's the best way to support someone who's been through abuse?
I think by providing whatever they need. Should it be a support group? Should it be getting out and going to a senior center and talking about things with other seniors, bringing in family members who perhaps weren't involved, and involving them more in that person's life. I mean, we see family members scattered all over the United States who sadly don't have a lot of contact with their grandparent or parent.
Yeah, it's difficult. And Doreen, you're project coordinator for an abuse in later life grant in Walworth County. Can you talk about that? What's going on there?
I sure can. And there's another person at GWAR who is also a project coordinator for La Crosse, Polk, and Dunn counties. And the goal of this grant is to train law enforcement to recognize elder abuse and take appropriate action, and to recognize that these are crimes. They're not just civil issues if someone is being stolen from, etc. Getting them to cooperate and work closely with Adult Protective Services. Some law enforcement agencies aren't even aware of that there is an Adult Protective Service agency that they can contact, and they can conduct a joint investigation together. We're also, as part of this grant, sending judges to training on elder abuse so that they can more effectively deal with it in the courtroom. We are training prosecutors to hopefully bring forth more charges regarding elder abuse situations. And then we are also providing cross training for direct service providers. And that service providers can be anyone who touches the life of an elder. It can be an employee at a group home or an assisted living or a hospital. So we're trying to just bring more education and awareness to the whole issue of elder abuse.
And from your end, Amber, I imagine it's tough to see these cases come to your desk.
Yeah, they touch us deeply, I think, in a lot of different ways. And as Doreen had said, often can be very devastating, whether financial, emotional, physical, or like Doreen mentioned, we do see poly victimization in most, if not all, cases. And so they are difficult. And I think presenting them to juries and to courts is a challenge for prosecutors, and training like what's being provided through the grant is just really phenomenal to help prosecutors sort of gather all of our tools and really get a deep look at them and figure out how to use those tools to best help our victims, whichever way they come into the system.
Yeah. And I expect that grant, part of the purpose of that grant may be that it's something that then other areas can be able to take up the materials that have been developed and the training and so forth, Doreen.
Yes, the Department of Justice actually received the first grant several years back, and that focused on four other counties, which was Milwaukee, Outagamie, Door County, and the Oneida Nation. And so they reapplied to expand upon that, and that is how we are now into, the other four counties that I mentioned. So it's a very scripted training. It can be used anywhere. Currently, they're using this training for cadets coming out of the academy in Milwaukee, which has been very, very powerful.
I'm wondering, we have nursing homes throughout the state, and we haven't really addressed that, and hopefully that abuse doesn't occur there very often, but I imagine it can happen there.
It can, and it does, pretty regularly. My advice for anyone who has a parent or a grandparent in some sort of a facility is to visit often, check often, and make sure that your loved one is being taken care of.
Yeah, and if you suspect, Amber, if there, or what goes on if you think, hey, this is not right?
Yeah, I would just add to that. And if you're not in a position where you can visit regularly, maybe you live out of state, like Doreen mentioned earlier, or you're not as close, maybe you call them or you talk to them on FaceTime or something, but you can't maybe physically get there. If something, if you see something, say something. If there's something that tickles your mind that, hey, that just doesn't seem quite right, you can contact the Adult Protective Services in the county where your loved one is residing, in that facility, and they can go out and do that in-person visit. And so it never, like I said, it never hurts to just have that extra check. Even if nothing comes of it, and maybe you were overreacting or whatever, no problem. Your report still gets that response. And that can be really helpful. But I agree with Doreen that not that we shouldn't, you don't need to suspect everyone, but just keep your eyes open. And if something's not right, trust your instincts.
For sure. I'm wondering, just on the other side of it, if you have an elderly person who needs to go into a home, an assisted living facility or a memory care facility, what are the things that you would, Doreen, what would you look for if you had a loved one that needed to be in that situation?
I say do your homework thoroughly. The Department of Health Services has a website that anybody has access to. It's the Division of Quality Assurance, and they are responsible for licensing facilities. And they also are the place where complaints are lodged. So you can look on their website to see if this facility has had complaints. You can look at their past history, etc. So you really need to do your homework. And yes, it's a little cumbersome to get to all those places, but it's well worth it in the long run.
Yeah. And so what's the best place to look then again?
Under the Department of Health Services, the Division of Quality Assurance.
Marty in Lake Geneva, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Marty.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A previous caller mentioned that they had a relative in another state. In this day and age with CCTV cameras everywhere, don't these facilities have cameras throughout? And I'll listen to your answer off air.
No. Thanks. All right. Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So in a lot of these facilities, people are receiving personal cares. So some of them need assistance with toileting and other things. And so it's not really appropriate to have cameras throughout those types of facilities. Some of them may certainly have cameras, but they're generally, or they should be, only in more sort of large gathering rooms and not so much in the rooms where people are residing. And so, I mean, yes and no, there might be some cameras available, but probably if you have somebody who is being abused, you know, probably your perpetrator is not going to be doing that in an area that would have a camera.
Yeah, I suppose there might be cameras by the doors as well, to, you know, if somebody was going to walk out the door, although I know there are ways that can be avoided. So it's a big problem, I think. Well, if there's even one, to be perfectly honest, that is a problem. And we've got over 10,000 of them reported here in the state. And once again, in this last minute or so, if you think something is happening to a loved one, what do you do?
I say trust your gut, trust your instincts, and report. You don't have to prove that this is occurring. You just have to think it. You can remain anonymous and make a report. And just trust your own judgment, because oftentimes that is correct.
Yeah. And Amber, from your end?
Yeah, I totally agree. And if you're not sure what to do, you know, you can always pull up your web browser to Google or Bing or whatever your preferred one is, and type in Adult Protective Services or the county where the individual you're worried about is residing. Or like Doreen said, we have a statewide one here in Wisconsin that they'll do that work for you. So you just report it right to the state line, and they will refer it out to the proper county. Definitely echoing what Doreen said.
Well, I'm sorry we've had to have to talk about this in a way, but I'm really glad that you both were able to come and be with us today. I think everybody learned a lot. There are probably going to be a few phone calls and a few emails or going online to some of those sites to make those reports, and I hope that happens, and I really hope we can do this again. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Doreen Gash is a social worker who works with elder abuse victims through the Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging Resources. Amber Hahn, Assistant District Attorney for Fond du Lac County. They're doing some wonderful work, and it's unfortunate they have to. I'm sure they would rather be doing something else, but I'm really glad they're doing their work for sure. Well, we're going to stay with memory loss and that sort of thing and aging, and we're going to take a look next at treating and possibly preventing memory loss. That next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. You know, there are few health concerns scarier to consider than dementia. And for many of us, the thought of losing, you know, the thought of losing your ability to remember and to think clearly, that's a terrifying thought. But there are Wisconsin researchers hard at work to find out how we can treat and possibly prevent memory loss. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today. We're lucky to have Dr. Nathaniel Chen as our guest. He's a geriatrician, memory clinic doctor, medical director for the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, and he's the host of the Dementia Matters podcast, which explores the treatment and care of people living with dementia. So as we talk with Dr. Chen, I hope you'll join in. What are your questions about risks for Alzheimer's disease and dementia? Maybe it runs in your family. Are you worried you may receive a diagnosis later in life? Or what are you wondering about how you can prepare? Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Nathaniel Chen, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
There's a lot we do not know about the cause of dementia, but what are the primary risk factors for memory loss later in life?
Well, Larry, first, the most common brain diseases that cause dementia are going to be Alzheimer's disease, vascular disease, Parkinson's disease, a cousin of it called Lewy body disease, and then frontal temporal disease. But those are all accumulations of proteins in the brain or blood vessel narrowing. And then when we think of other factors below the head that can affect our thinking, that's going to be things like our mood, sleep apnea, physical inactivity, thyroid conditions, vitamin deficiencies. So there's a whole bunch of things that we can address that can actually affect our thinking ability.
Are there some, there have to be some common myths about dementia?
Yes. The most common is that it's a normal part of aging, and it is not a normal part of aging. There are plenty of people who live a really long and healthy life that never develop advanced thinking changes. I use the word advanced because we do see thinking changes as we get older. We call those age-related thinking changes. But dementia is not something that has to happen. And certainly that's why we are so focused on trying to treat it and then ultimately prevent it.
And Alzheimer's is probably the most commonly understood or known, I should say, cause of dementia. What changes are happening in the brain when you develop Alzheimer's?
In Alzheimer's disease, there is this accumulation of two proteins that we are not able to get rid of. The first one is called amyloid, and that develops first. The second one, which develops years later, is called the tau protein. And those two proteins lead to dysfunction in the connections among brain cells and then eventually lead to brain cell death. And when you don't have as many brain cells, you don't have the communication, and therefore you start having symptoms. And so we really learn this timeline or this progression of Alzheimer's because of our research participants. And in particular in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention, there are 1,800 fantastic Wisconsin people who are followed every other year for over 20 years. And we're really learning a lot because of their dedication.
Oh, that's wonderful. Preventable. You mentioned preventable. How preventable is dementia?
Well, there's good evidence that between 30 and 40% of dementia cases are preventable. Now, I'm not saying Alzheimer's disease here. I'm saying dementia, the ultimate,
right,
the big umbrella. But about 40% is a number that's commonly used in the field.
Boy. And what about actions? What actions can you take to reduce the risk of dementia? And is there anything relating to reducing the Alzheimer's disease for yourself?
Well, I'll answer the second question by saying we're really looking into that. What can we do that impacts this amyloid protein or the tau protein? But really, when it comes to dementia itself, you know, I think of it as four main things about how can we address or how do we look at prevention. The first one is looking at things like depression, your thyroid, vitamin deficiencies. This is the reason why people really should go and talk to their primary care provider and get evaluated, because they're very common and they can be treated. But the other things are looking at vascular risk factors, so blood vessel health. And so that's things like diabetes or your blood sugar, high blood pressure, if you're smoking, obesity, just weight in general, and then physical inactivity. Those are all been linked to having a higher risk of dementia, and they're all very treatable. But then there are other things that I like to think about that are more pro-health or pro-well-being, and that's exercising, eating well, being social, keeping your brain stimulated. And then the last thing there I would tell you is we really have to protect our brain. So that's wearing a helmet, wearing a seatbelt, so any preventing head injuries. And then more recently, which has been covered by WPR, hearing loss and making sure that we're identifying and treating hearing loss.
You know, let's say there's somebody out there listening and 60 years old and says, you know what, I don't do exercises. I don't eat right. Probably too late for me anyway. Or is it?
Absolutely not. It's never too late. It's always a good place to start is today. And I would actually say when people tell me, oh, I don't exercise, I don't eat well, all I say is, well, great. We have this huge room for improvement. And so I just want you to walk then. If you're not ready to go for a swim or go on the elliptical machine, then please give me 5 minutes of walking. And on days like today and yesterday, there's really no excuse, right? Or if you can't walk, and there are plenty of people who have those disabilities, then let's do some chair exercises. So there's always a way, Larry.
Elaine and DePeer has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Elaine.
Hi, this is Elaine.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I already told the other gal, but when I was 79, I'd been falling, and the EMTs had to come pick me up, and I'm a little overweight. Anyway, they took me, my kids took me to a neurologist. I'd never been to one. And after they gave me some tests and this and that, the doctor told them she is not to be left alone. She needs special care. I was in a wheelchair. But then he did some blood tests. And he found out that my B12 essence, there hardly was any. So he put me on shots. I had 2 a month for 3 months and then 1 a month. And then when I saw him a year later, I got, instead of 18 out of 30, I got 29 out of 30. I could sit down, put my arms out, and stand up. I had not been in a wheelchair. I had not called the EMTs for 7 or 8 months.
Wow, that is, that's something, B12, and Dr. Chin, that may sounds like it worked in Elaine's case. Is that something that...
This is a great story. And Elaine, thank you for sharing it because it shows the importance of looking for other factors. Everyone always thinks it's Alzheimer's, and it's not always Alzheimer's. And so B12 is one that we look for. Vitamin D, vitamin B6, vitamin B1. These are all vitamin levels that, if really low, like in Elaine's case, can cause symptoms. And when we treat them, people can, I don't promise it, but people can feel better. And when Elaine had repeat testing, she performed better. So I'm really happy to hear that story, Elaine, and I'm glad that that level was checked.
Yeah, and that would be something that I guess if you were suspecting that in maybe in yourself or maybe in a loved one, that would be something you would ask if you went to see the doctor? Ask
for? That is true. Yep, Larry, that's true. And I would say all primary care doctors know to check a B12 in someone who feels like they're having memory changes. Now, in Elaine's case, she was also having balance changes. And so the neurologist knew that for balance. But primary care doctors are very capable of addressing a lot of the reversible factors and doing a very good screen to look for possible causes of a person having thinking changes.
And I would think, you know, your doctor that you see all the time, your doctor should be in a good position knowing you to help you with dementia prevention.
I agree completely, Larry. They know their patients the best. They know their histories the best. And ideally, they have the best rapport with their patients so they can talk about memory changes. You know, there's a lot of stigma, Larry, to a person experiencing or worrying about memory loss. And your primary knows you, and hopefully you have that trusting relationship where you can start the conversation.
And so if you notice symptoms, I mean, first, you know, I have been I'm known to look for my glasses when they're on top of my head. If you start to, what are some signs that you yourself can sort of self-diagnosed, at least to begin with?
Well, Larry, I'd never encourage self-diagnosis, but I appreciate your question of where, you know, what are the earliest changes or what should you do?
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, if you are noticing something and it's persistent and it is starting to get in the way of your ability to not only enjoy your day, but just get through the day, if it's impacting your day-to-day function, that is certainly something that you might want to ask your loved one or your close friend about. Do you notice this change? Maybe they don't. And if they do, or if you're still worried, despite what them trying to reassure you, then I think it's worth going in to talk to your primary care and say, listen, I would like to be at least briefly assessed for that and see what you find.
Dr. Nathaniel Chin, our guest today, geriatrician, memory clinic doctor. It's great to have him with us, and he'll be with us till 12:30 today, and you'll have a chance to answer or ask your questions as well. Take a quick look at the news, and we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for spending some of your day with us here on WPR. We're talking about dementia on the show right now with our guest, Dr. Nathaniel Chin, a geriatrician, a memory clinic doctor, medical director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, and host of the Dementia Matters podcast. It explores the treatment and care of people living with dementia. So tell us what you're doing to keep your brain and memory healthy. What do you want to know about the latest in dementia research? Give us a call. Number's 800-642-1234. Send an email otherwise to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call from Bob in Mount Horeb next. Bob, hi.
Yeah, thank you so much for this program. I'm aware of the connection between hearing loss and dementia. And my mom has recently been diagnosed, and she has severe hearing loss. And I'm worried that any hearing aid is going to be too difficult for her to operate and maintain. She scored a 16 on the mental status exam. Are there hearing aids that, I'm sorry about the wind, are there hearing aids that would help in this situation?
Dr.
That
Chin?
Is an excellent, yeah, that's an excellent question, and an unfortunate situation, but one that is still feasible. So I would say that there are hearing aids that are simpler that people can use. I would also say there are these devices called pocket talkers that we in the geriatric clinics use frequently. And so it's very much like a Walkman where it has a headset and it's connected to a little device with a little microphone at the end. And people use that in more intimate gatherings and small conversations where it amplifies the sound. In fact, people with hearing aids will sometimes use a pocket talker when they have severe hearing loss. And so I would say that that would be worth trying or working with a hearing specialist in seeing for the simpler hearing aids to see if that would be beneficial for Bob's mom.
Yeah. Bob, thank you. Jenny in Elkhorn has a question relating to this in a way. She's been having difficulties with her primary care doc about hearing loss and possible dementia. Wonders, how can you navigate communicating with a doctor who doesn't seem to listen to your concerns?
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. And I guess I would start by saying, you know, it starts with the advocating for yourself and asking for the referral. There are many memory clinics across the state through the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute. We have many clinics that are primary care driven, but have the specialty focus of memory. And so you could ask for that referral. You could reach out yourself. Or I would say having a very heartfelt one-on-one conversation with that primary care doctor to express your concern and why you are concerned and asking directly for a thorough evaluation.
If you notice common symptoms or notice symptoms of dementia, just reaching out for support, what are your tips for finding a good doctor to find answers about your memory loss?
Well, again, I would start with your primary care, but I would say in the state of Wisconsin, each of our aging and disability resource centers has what's called a dementia specialist, and so, or dementia care specialist. And that is usually someone with a lot of medical background, but also special training, who can help you find memory care providers. You could also go to the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute website and look for our network. I mean, these are multiple, it is not UW specific, multiple health systems where people are leading memory clinics. And so through those connections, you would be able to find someone in your area or at least within driving distance.
You know, last month, I think it was, there was a study funded by the National Institute of Aging that found a link between living in a disadvantaged neighborhood and lower cognitive test scores. Can you tell us about how our environment is related to our brain and memory health?
Yeah, this was a very interesting study, and it was actually using a tool that was designed and created by one of our own, our geriatrician, Dr. Amy Kine. It's called the Neighborhood Atlas, which is free for anyone. You could go online and look at it. And it's really looking at environmental social factors in your neighborhood. So using block census data that's publicly available. And what this particular study found was that it was looking at both race and area, this area deprivation index. And what it found was that regardless of race, if you live in a more disadvantaged neighborhood, you perform worse on thinking tests. And they accounted for education, for some genetics, other health factors. And so it really speaks to the fact that when it comes to our thinking ability, there are other external factors at play that we can address. And a lot of this is policy driven, but a lot of it is under our own control, whether it's the foods that we eat or how active we are. But studies like this one, and using the tool, this Neighborhood Atlas, is really allowing for not only scientists, but I would say the public policymakers to see that there are other things that we can do outside of a clinic that can make a meaningful benefit to the community.
Yeah. Jim in La Crosse, we'll give you a chance. Thank you for calling, Jim.
Yeah. Hi. I'm dealing with a person who's extremely, extremely hostile to the idea of discussing what possibly may be some disability in thinking. What do I do then?
Yeah, so you're not alone in this, Jim. You know, there's again, because there's so much stigma and fear that most people will become defensive. And that's in addition to denial about what they're experiencing. And so, this is not evidence-based, Jim. So in my experience, approaching that person, and I'm presuming in this situation, this is a loved one or someone you care about, and saying, I am worried for these reasons. I want to be there for you for these reasons, but I need to know what we're dealing with and what we're looking at. And for me to best do that, it would be looking to get an evaluation so that I can be the best partner for you or family member or friend. And therefore, are you willing to go in with me to talk to this provider, to look for reversible factors first? And if it's not that, then we'll face this journey together and I will be there with you. But I need to know what's happening in order to do that.
Yeah. Jim, thank you for calling. Good luck. Appreciate your call. What role does mental health and emotional well-being play in terms of risk of dementia later in life?
Well, depression is one of the main risk factors, one of the most powerful risk factors for dementia later in life. Also, what's tricky about this is that mood changes could actually be one of the first changes of an actual disease in the brain. And so there's a lot of research looking at that. So they're intertwined, which to me just says it's incredibly important that we address our mental well-being as well as our physical well-being. And likely the outcome of doing that is going to be not only feeling better, but then protecting our brain.
Yeah, and I'm thinking too about chronic stress, anxiety. This has got to affect risks for dementia.
You're preaching to the choir here, Larry. I feel it and I agree with you completely. And when you are chronically stressed, now stress in general is not a bad thing. It's what prompts us to get things done evolutionarily. It's what prompted us to run away from that attack. But when it's chronic and daily from the lives that we're living, you're having too much cortisol in your body. You're having too much of this sympathetic nervous system drive. And that is leading to negative outcomes, blood vessel health, brain sizes becoming a little bit smaller, obesity, high blood pressure. So there's lots of negative effects from the way that our society just lives in general when we have chronic stress that we don't address.
Yeah. You had this research, Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. What research are you focusing on?
Well, our program, we're one of 37 nationally funded centers in Alzheimer's and related causes of dementia. And we happen to be focused on what's called, three things. One is preclinical, meaning individuals at risk of developing thinking changes who currently feel okay. So we want people to come in as early as possible so that we can really understand their experience and then watch them as they get older. The second is what we call biomarker research. So we're very interested in lumbar punctures, PET scans, blood tests, even finger stick blood tests, looking to understand the proteins that build up and how can we better identify things as people are getting older. And then our third area is looking at representation and the need to improve our racial understanding of Alzheimer's disease. So bringing in communities of color, communities from different areas, rural communities, veterans, so that we can understand the biology of Alzheimer's in all people and not just in a certain segment.
Yeah. Carol in Green Bay has a question for you. Carol, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, guest. This is just a quick question about, you know, I do wish sometimes when it came to tests, medical tests, that I couldn't see the report, because a lot of times it's more upsetting, I think, than it needs to be. I'll see my neurologist again in another month. But here's the thing. I have multiple sclerosis, so that's why I get these once a year, full set of MRIs from my brain through my lumbar. At this last one, with my brain, it's indicating a thinning and attenuation of the corpus callosum. And I'm 65. Can you tell me if that's like a normal thing with aging? I mean, I certainly feel like I'm still sharp.
Well, Carol, first of all, I'm glad you're still feeling like you're sharp, because that's really the most important.
You sound pretty sharp too, by the way.
The second thing is, you're not the only one who wishes that we could withhold some of the labs just temporarily, or the imaging findings temporarily, so that I could then, or the doctors could actually reach out and talk to people about it, because it is a lot of medical jargon. And the third is, you know, while I can't speak specifically to that scan, you know, that isn't an area that I look to when I think about memory change. And so that might be related to what the neurologist is looking at related to your multiple sclerosis. But that doesn't, to me, jump out as an area that would initially concern me when it comes to thinking ability. But again, I'll go back to point number one. You sounds sharp. And so as long as you're feeling good, that's a really good sign.
Yeah. Thank you, Carol. Rick in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hi. There seems to be a lot of controversy and contradicting opinions about supplements. And I'm wondering what your opinion is of supplements that are supposed to enhance memory and cognitive function. Specifically, I take ginkgo biloba and phosphatidylserine, I think it's pronounced. And I'm wondering if you think it's just a big waste of money, or what your opinion is of that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
This is a great question. It's one I get a lot when I talk to communities. There is a great debate about supplements. And the reason is that there's not a lot of evidence to support supplements when a person is not deficient in a vitamin. So we heard earlier that when someone's B12 deficient, you certainly want to be on a B12 supplement. But when someone tests in a normal level, there's no scientific study to support that a person is going to do better or feel better on the supplement. Now, on the other side of that, just because there isn't a study doesn't mean that a person may not feel better being on a certain thing like the one that you're on with ginkgo. And I believe there was a study on ginkgo, and it's unclear to me, I'm sorry, what the actual result was. But even if it was negative, if a person feels better on it, I never tell them to stop. I just tell them I don't know that the evidence is there to support the use of it. But I think it's more important to talk about it because, frankly, if it interacts with a prescription medication, that could have a side effect that makes you feel worse. And we want to make sure that doesn't happen. And frankly, you know, we just want to be upfront with each other about what we're taking, what we're comfortable taking. I would say there are a lot of supplements out there that specifically target brain health. And I'm not going to list any names in the show, but if they say this promotes your memory, there's really no evidence for those in particular. And it really just is a combination of parts of supplements that go into one pill, and they're very expensive. So in that regard, I do worry about the cost of medication of these supplements and the limited to no benefit from receiving them.
Yeah. Rick, thank you so much. On the other hand, there are some pills, not supplements, but Donepezil comes to mind, that when you're looking at early stage Alzheimer's, at least, there can be positive effects. Certainly, I have a sister who's early stage Alzheimer's, and the Donepezil has made a very big difference in the quality of her life.
Well, and that is one that we do prescribe, and what it does is it blocks the natural breakdown of a chemical signal in your brain that helps you with your memory and your attention. So it doesn't create it, and it naturally will, your body will still break it down at some point. But this idea that let's promote more of the signal and healthy brain cells will take it up and use it, which is why it is used in individuals with mild all the way to moderate and severe stage dementia. And some people with mild cognitive impairment may talk to their provider about it as well, but it can have its place. I mean, some people don't benefit at all, Larry, and they will report that to me. And other people have side effects and they can't be on it. But the field certainly hasn't had a lot of drugs, oral pill drugs, since 2003, 2004. And so there's been this dearth of medications for people. Donepezil remains very commonly used.
Yeah. Well, it made a big difference, and it was making a big difference in her life. And certainly her attitude and outlook is much improved. William in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, William.
Hi, this is William Chase. I was calling regarding, I read somewhere that if you don't get enough sleep, there's plaque that builds up on your brain. And if you get a deep sleep, then there's enzymes that wash away the plaque that causes dementia. Is that true? Or I don't know if something that I read that was wrong.
No, so sleep is incredibly important. So that is very true. Sleep, people who sleep better, I should say people who don't sleep well, don't perform as well on thinking tests. They have higher weights, higher blood pressure, lower moods. And so sleep is really important just for your overall well-being. But in addition to that, when it comes to Alzheimer's disease specifically, we have seen that the amyloid plaques, that first protein, gets cleared normally during the deep phase of your sleep. So stage three sleep. And so people who never get into stage three or deep sleep, or they don't do it enough, there's this belief that then the protein isn't being cleared out at the way it should. And so then can sort of build up and stay in the brain. So we do see this as a risk factor to Alzheimer's disease, or at least the biology of Alzheimer's. But really we're still looking into it directly to see if there's a way for us to use this to treat, prevent, or address Alzheimer's disease.
William, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Dan in Westby. Hi, Dan. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Dan Small here. I heard part of your conversation about the connection between hearing loss and dementia. And I recently, finally, after many years of having poor hearing, started working with a clinic that's called Professional Hearing Care, LLC. They have offices in Fitchburg and here in Westby and La Crosse and Mauston as well. And they very clearly show the connection between improving hearing ability with a prescription hearing aid, not just an over-the-counter hearing aid, and reducing the decline of cognitive ability toward dementia. It's they do occasionally symposiums around the state, and they do a free, I think most audiologists do, but they will offer a free exam so you can not only learn what your hearing ability is, but what your cognitive function is, and then you can learn about the improving the connection between the two. I don't want to lose what little cognitive function I have left. And you and I are in that same generation, I think. Yeah. I'm wearing hearing aids now, and it's helped a lot.
Yeah. Dan, thank you so much for calling. A comment, Dr. Chen.
Well, I think Dan speaks to the fact that it's not just about thinking, it's about your quality of life. But certainly when you can hear, you can focus, and that helps with learning and memory and just overall thinking ability. It also helps with socialization, your willingness to engage and be stimulated. I do want to clarify, though, there aren't any clinical trials yet to date that have shown that wearing a hearing aid, you know, actually reduces the risk directly of developing dementia. There is a really good study out that I talked about on a WPR show where there could be a signal in those at the highest risk who had a lot of vascular risk factors. But we do need more scientific studies before we can say conclusively that putting a hearing aid will reduce your risk of thinking change. But for Dan's sake, you know, he noticed this difference. And so I think that's very valuable. And I think a lot of people will feel that way. But I just want to make sure people know we don't yet have the solid evidence base to say that for everybody.
Yeah. Dan, thank you again for calling. You host, Dr. Chen, the Dementia Matters podcast, and maybe tell us about that.
Well, thank you, Larry. Yes, it's one of the highlights of my job. I love seeing patients. I love working with researchers, but I certainly love talking to the community, and the podcast is a way to do that. I record about 20 to 30-minute segments with researchers across the world, really, and then actually participants now, too, and other specialists in caregiving. And the point of it really is to share information in meaningful and digestible ways to the public so that they know what science is doing, what researchers are doing, but other tips to not only stay healthy, but to provide the best care for their loved one or their friend. And so it's a great joy. I meet with a lot of different people, and we have an episode come out every other week, and we work with other institutions, including other federally funded people. And the idea just being, we all have concerns, we all have skin in this game. And so if we can share the information that's evidence-based, that's reliable, then more people can listen and ideally break down the stigma of thinking changes.
And it's Dementia Matters. That's the name of your
Correct.
Dr. Chen, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. I hope we can do this again. There's lots more we could be covering here. And thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. I've had a great time.
Dr. Nathaniel Chen, geriatrician, memory clinic doctor, and director, medical director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Research Center. Great to have him with us. Looking ahead, tomorrow is our sports show, our monthly sports show. And among other things, we'll be looking at those NCAA brackets for the tournaments. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.